On the 14th of July at Landmark was Johnny Moffat, and his subject was Ireland to Fern Hill.
It's been a roller coaster, as you all know. I found among older people what was a bit sad about coming out of lockdown. They found the peace, the birds, and it was just an amazing time which we've experienced. Johnny's got a lot to say and it's worth listening to. He's a gentleman that's traversed the world, sports fields, boardrooms, and a lot of Hawke's Bay soil. So a big story to tell, and I'm so grateful you agreed to do it, Johnny. I won't apologise for the fact that he's never picked up the New Zealand language, but he's, I think, standing.
Well, in response to that, Joyce, I have to say, when I first came to New Zealand, I thought they sounded a bit like Cockneys, and I wasn't born there. I'm surprised so many people have not got something better to do on a Tuesday morning, but I was born in 1937 and grew up on the outskirts of Belfast, listening to the German bombers coming over. Wow, wow, wow. I've never forgotten it. And all the houses sandbagged up over the windows on the ground floor. My father, actually in 1941, volunteered, because there was no conscription in Northern Ireland, and went to England as a private and went to Burma on the front line. He never spoke much about what went on and all the Japanese they shot. But he was there for 4 years and came back as a major. And he had bought a little farm out of Belfast for us at Ballyeesborough, and my sister was 2 years younger, and we lived there on the farm out of Belfast for quite a few years. My mother was one of critics for the BBC. They had about 60 or 70 critics around Great Britain, and between the age of 3 and 5 she spent all her time teaching me language, mathematics, English. Extraordinary. There's been a bit of publicity about how absorptive people can be at that age. But I was at the local public elementary school, Ballyhalbert, and in 1944, the head teacher told my mother I was so far ahead of anybody at the school, she sent me to boarding school in Belfast. So that was during the war, and I had 11 years of boarding after that, and we had practices at air raid shelters. But at the age of 15, my father, who'd come back from the war and was running a family wholesale drapery business in Belfast, he told me there'll be no wholesale drapers, there'll be producers and retail outlets, corporatization all around the world, so you'll never come back to this business. And in the meantime, he'd bought a little 4-acre lifestyle block outside Newton Arts. And post-school, I was working for a veggie farmer, going to go and do agriculture college for a year, and then hopefully university in agriculture. And one day on the holidays, my father spotted something in the newspaper. They were offering scholarships to Edinburgh and Aberdeen University worth £300 a year each. And he said, "You've got to enter for that. It's money for old rope." And so I said, "Well, I know nothing about forestry." And he said, "Well, you were in the British Schools exploring team in northern British Columbia just 2 years ago, and all your time you spent in forests." So I went down to the local library and read up about forestry, went for an interview. There were 4 senior civil servants there, and I had captained the Ulster Schools rugby team the year before. And they talked about rugby, and 15 minutes later sent me out the door. Forestry never got a mention. And that's what it was like in the amateur days. And I was about to start agriculture college and haven't heard anything. A little bit typical of civil service, I have to say, in Northern Ireland. I hadn't heard anything, and I rang up and got shunted around Parliament, and eventually got one of the guys who had interviewed me, and he said, "Oh, which university you want to go to?" So away I spent 4 years getting a 3-year degree, and then back to Northern Ireland. I played rugby for I got the degree, but I played rugby for the Scottish universities in North Midlands, one of four provinces in Scotland at that time, and started my job as an assistant district forest officer. It was a great job for practicing goal picking and training. And my boss for the last 2 years there was an alcoholic, so I covered up from him and I just did what I liked. And in 1961, I was picked to play against England at Lansdowne Road, and we hadn't beaten England in 10 years. And going out in the bus, about four seats forward from the back, I'm listening to Sid Miller, who was Ballymena man, persuading Ronnie Dawson that I should do the goal kicking and not Tommy Kiernan. So I thought, on reflection, many years later, I'm glad I didn't get that news 4 days earlier, just an hour before kickoff. And anyway, it was a gale blowing and I had to have somebody holding the ball from each touchline. But I got two penalties before half time and one into the wind in the second half conversion, and we won 11-8. And the newspapers the next day, I just had full headlines. Moffat destroys England. Even Bowden Barrett would be pleased with that one. Another one, Ballymena blonde bombshell blasts Ireland to victory. And another more reserved one in the Times, Moffat brought joy to the Irish. And the following Tuesday in the Ballymena newspaper, they published a little article saying there was no truth in the rumour that Moffat had left all his clothes in Dublin and come home with a suitcase full of newspapers. But 2 weeks later, we went to Scotland, lost the match, and five of us got dropped. But in 62-63, that season, I was captain of Ballymena, and it had Willie John McBride and Sid Miller, who was later president of World Rugby. And pre-season, I'd been playing for the public school Wanderers tour in Cornwall, and that was a London club that had won two Hong Kong sevens. But before the first game, when I was captain of the side at that time, I met this Gary Jemison, who was an 18-year-old, played for Hope's Bay against the British Lions in 59. And he came up to me the night before the first match and said, there's something I should tell you, Johnny. I haven't had a run for 18 months. He talked his way on as an all-black trialist onto this tour, which was all rubbish. He'd had his car stolen and all his gear stolen in London. He was a simple Hawke's Bay farmer's son, and life was very honest in those days. So he told me, and I didn't give him too much ball from halfback, but I could see the talent and talked him into coming over to Ballymena and staying with the Bet and I in Country House and playing that season. And we took the Senior Cup out of Belfast, the first time in 80 years since rugby had started, to a country town, so that was a good party. And on the way down to Cornwall, 6 months previously, I'd read a book called First Overland by Tim Slessor, and it was an Oxford and Cambridge group of guys in two Land Rovers. They painted dark blue and light blue, had driven from Belfast to Singapore, overland, and 12 months later we were on our way. A Hillman Husky van, duty free for export. When eventually I got there, I managed to sell it for double the price it paid for. It was quite a journey. And I'd copped hepatitis in India and wasn't able to play rugby here for the first season. And I was in hospital in Singapore for 2 weeks and then flew to Darwin and hitchhiked Darwin to Sydney. Gary had flown home. And it was quite an experience in Northern Australia because I got picked up hitchhiking and always wore a clean shirt and so on. But a Seppels rep picked me up and we went through all the country towns in North Queensland. And then we came to one pub. It was late afternoon, we went in to see the manager, and the big mama behind the bar came out, said, "George, great to see you." Walked across, grabbed him by the crutch and said, "Is he getting much exercise?" "No, welcome to Australia." Then a few days later, I saw a little shop on the side of the road in North Queensland, and a lady there, I said, "Do you get many tourists up from New South Wales here?" "They come up with a £5 note and a dirty shirt, and they don't change either." So Gary met me down in Wellington when I got off the plane from Sydney, and he had copped a bit of hepatitis too, and so we weren't going to be playing the first half of the season anyway. But his father was very friendly with Mr. Francis, who was headmaster of Lindisfarne, and I'd worked in France as golf instructor for 3 months previous to the drive over. So I took 3 classes of French, and the previous French teacher had been doing French dictation with English pronunciation, however that works. Very sad, but it was a good year there, and I later heard certain I'd never taught before, but when anybody in the classroom was talking to the fellow next door or not paying attention, I just grabbed a stick of chalk and fired him, and I was quite accurate. And a lot of those boys who are in their 70s now remind me of it. And the headmaster, apparently long after I left, said to a few people, "Well, I don't know how much he taught them, but they certainly enjoyed his classes." At the end of the year, I married Christine Walker from Walker's Nurseries here today, and we went and worked in far north Queensland and learned then that my father had left home and gone down to Africa, so my mother was on her own. We drove across Australia and then took the boat to Greece, and then did another public school wanderers tour and played another season for Ballymena. Then we planned with John Robb, who was a surgeon. He had driven with us to Singapore, and we did a trip down from Belfast to Cape Town overland and stayed with my father. I worked for Rhodes Fruit Farms for a few months, and Chris was modelling there, but the future didn't look good for South Africa, and we took the boat home by Australia. And I do remember standing outside on the deck looking at Wellington Harbour before we landed, looking at the land, thinking, "I'm 29, life's really starting now," never having driven a tractor or really worked seriously on land. And I worked for A.B. Smith, did some contract pruning, then Fred Horrocks on Oamaru Road. And in 68, the Fraser family, who had their eldest son drowned off Napier, I leased their peaches block, peaches and nectarines, 14 varieties, 50 trees each, $700 a year for the block, 12-foot steel ladders. At that time, there were a lot of working bees and people helping one another. I don't know, Vic Butcher, I played rugby with for Hastings, he was out working at the weekend. He's a plumbing business now in Hastings, and he was up the top of a 12-foot ladder, and he shouted down, "Do you want to know the time?" And I said, "Why?" And he said, "I can see the town clock from here." And that was the corner of Mariah Kakadu Road and Longlands Road. So I played 4 seasons for Hastings and captained them in 67. Working bees were big in those days, and the Rotary Club used to go out and pick peaches to raise funds for them. And the YMCA owned an orchard at Longlands Road, and it came up for sale because Waddies were going to cancel their contract. And I managed to speak to the operations manager, their field officer, and said, "Well, I'll buy it from them for $30,000 if you'll give me the contract." So we did that for about 3 years. And at that time, I had a little overseas funds my father had left me. And you could buy a new vehicle from Paul Jones, who's not listening at the moment. You could buy the vehicle duty-free for export and sell it. You drove it for a year, and you could sell it for double the price at the end of the year. That was very advantageous, and very close with Paul and Sylvia and all their young kids, and we used to go away up north camping and having holidays in early part of January. That was very formative. And I realized that the Hurritonga Plains, the western edge, was higher and earlier, production better, because the cold air slides down and then gets trapped against the hills in Havelock. And when I had both orchards going, we would have two picks of Golden Queen at Coroquipo before we ever went down to Longlands. But during the time I had peaches that I worked with at Longlands, I worked with Alan Chittick face to face across the trees for 2-3 months, pruning most of our orchard and all of his. And so you get to know somebody quite well when you're just there, the two of you, chatting across as you're pruning. And then in late 73, the opportunity to purchase Coroquipo came up, and I sold the block to Brian Hutchison, who's here today, and that was official. And then we leased it back just on the basis of a handshake, and that worked well. There's no legal discipline about it, but it worked. And in those days, when it purchased the Coroquipo, there was a view, if you stood on the Fernhill Bridge, you could almost see Waiheke, and there were just dairy farms all the way across. So we managed to purchase 67 acres there. Some of it was already in apples, and the rest in maize. One of the worries about growing apples at that stage was getting labor there, because not many people had cars. But we, mums and kids, came out and worked from 9 till 3. That worked very, very well. I got to know a lot of people from that time. But I wasn't prepared to pack apples at night, because most people were just doing them in little sheds, and it's really effective. And the fruit packers had formed about 2-3 years before and had about 30 shareholders. And so I joined fruit packers, and then 3 years on, in 1976, I became a director, and in 82, became chairman. And that continued for 36 years until 2018, and I'm now reduced to deputy chairman. But we had gone from 70 shareholders to 14 with the disaster in the early 2000s, and we could see that if some of our non-shareholder suppliers, big growers, pulled out, we'd be in trouble. We went from 70 shareholders to 14 in quite a short period. But from the time of Coroquipo, we bought a lot of land, come back in different stages. My son, Jaunty, he came back, and he had done his apprenticeship. He didn't like school, and he had started his apprenticeship with Paul Jones in 1968 at Hastings Motors. And there was a lot of suggestion within the staff that it was only because Paul and I were good mates that he got that job, but he got top apprenticeship award for Hawke's Bay in that year, so that was good. And later he went to Australia and worked on pipelines in the desert, and when everyone went to town to have a booze up at the weekend, he stayed out there and serviced the machinery and came home with quite a lot of money. He also, in England, worked for a contracting firm that operated machinery and only employed New Zealanders near Newmarket, and the New Zealanders made contacts with more and more, and so that's what I ended up with for 25 years, only New Zealanders. Second son, Joe, mechanical engineering degree in Christchurch, postgraduate in France, played rugby for Pont de Clay. He was provided with accommodation, and he was very athletic. And in 1986, there was the Centennial Cup to celebrate 100 years of skiing at Ruapehu. And all the pros were there with difficult conditions, but he won it, and he holds it for 100 years. And it lies in the back of his shed, covered in a whole lot of tubes. Then when he came back from overseas, he was Heinz Waddy's project engineer for 4 or 5 years, and then he came back to the family business. Sean, the third son, he did his apprenticeship as a builder, in Maunganui and finished with Magrathes. He was quite a daredevil, and he was base jumping in Australia and in the USA, and in 1991 he won the New Zealand swoop accuracy title at Taupo, where he sailed and come down off the plane, and then you've got a target on the shore, and then you've got to skim your feet through water and land closest to the target. Later he went to the Norwegian fjords, and he was base jumping off there when the cruise ships came in to witness them, the base jumpers doing from 2,000 feet. And I hadn't seen him for about 6 or 8 months, but my mother's 90th birthday was on at home, and I rang him, persuaded him to come over for the birthday party to Northern Ireland. So he flew to Edinburgh, took the rail to Glasgow, came overnight in the boat to Belfast, and my mother and I went up to meet him off the boat. And here was this individual with long blonde tassels all the way down his back, and they'd been intertwined by some lovely German girl with multicolored beads. So my mother, who was Methodist and never had drunk alcohol, she was quite silent when we met him. But we got the beads out of the hair over the next couple of days, and I was taking him up to the Giant's Causeway, and the rental car was leaking, and so we had to get it replaced at the airport, and he was going round to get the car. I did the paperwork, and it was raining, and there were three taxi drivers parked up in the covered way, and they're watching this apparition walking bare feet, surf shorts, hair down his back. And I walked in the covered way, and when I was opposite the taxi drivers, the one said to the other two, "Be a fucking Australian." So all came back to the family business. The combination of mechanic, engineer and builder was very, very convenient. And as Richard Jones told me years ago, when they had the big family business in Hastings, it's a poor family business if it can't have one waster, referring to Stuart Jones, who spent most of his time very successfully playing golf. We've got none. I go back to 1987 when I stood for the Apple and Pear Marketing Board, and John Pater, who'd done 9 previous years, was standing again. He hadn't become chairman or deputy chairman in those early days. And he came back on, and in October 87, I was down for an interview with Fruit Fed directors, I think. It was the day of the financial great crash, and I was walking up and down wondering what was going to happen in Wellington. And then a Christchurch director, whose name I've lost, when the interview was going on, he suddenly said, "You've got a university degree, and you played rugby for Ireland, you'll do me." So that was my access to the board. And the following year, it was suggested by some of the directors that I take over chairmanship, but I didn't take it on. Operations at home, I didn't want half of my time in a flat in Wellington. So I was deputy chairman for 7 years and made 230 return trips to Wellington in 9 years, many of them with John, who's here tonight. At least we had a car we could drive from the offices and get home on time and didn't have to wait for planes. But one night we were coming through the Manawatu Gorge and a rock came down and broke the window. I was driving at the time, broke the window behind me. So we had 5 or 10 minutes cleaning up the mess and putting some plastic in there. And then we just drove on, and 2 minutes later John says, "What are you planting this winter?" Yeah, well, he's always wanted to plant the entire Heritonga Plain. He's got very close, but hasn't quite got there. And then a few years later, in the mid-90s, we were changed from 4 Rohr appointed directors of the New Zealand Apple and Pear Board and 2 government appointees, and that was changed to 4 growers. and two commercial appointees. PricewaterhouseCoopers were our financial advisors, and they took part in that or witnessed the voting. And Wilson Winery was standing as a commercial appointee, but we already had his skills around the table and just wanted a super salesman that we'd have to control. So Wilson didn't get on, and PwC managing director came over to me after the voting and said, "I know why you didn't vote for Wilson Winery." I said, "Oh, why is that?" Prop forward. And when I left the Apple and Pear Board at the end of 96, after 9 years on it, we had 2,000 suppliers. 3 years later, when single desk selling was gone, fax selling, Dutch markets ended in a disaster because there was no training in a competitive world. It was very, very bad. And then we all, as suppliers, had shareholding in the Apple and Pear Board, that Tony Gibbs came under the radar and legally leased a couple of orchards down in the Wairarapa, and then began buying the shares. And he eventually took over the board. It was 3-4 years after John and I were involved. We had to go down to Wellington to speak to the Minister of Agriculture that Tony Gibbs couldn't have a monopoly. And there was a bit of mayhem then, and a lot of the quotable valuations of orchards in Hope's Bay came down by 40 to 45%. But the boys on our orchard had the courage to go to mortgagee sales, and we bought quite a few blocks all on Coraquipo Road or Swamp Road or the Marinary Settlement Road, and a lot of them were bought at $7,000 an acre, and today they're probably worth 40, 50, 60. Our neighbours have gone for 60,000 an acre. But much of that's overseas owned, which is sad. Today at Moffat Orchards, the family members own 6 separate titles, 4 with family homes on them, all leased to Moffat Orchards Limited. Moffat Holdings owns 6 blocks leased out to Moffat Orchards, all over the Fernhill Bridge. Total is now 200 hectares and 25 hectares leased, 100 hectares in apples, 125 hectares of rock melons, water melons, machine harvested green beans, machine harvested sweet corn, butternuts and courgettes, and we supply Countdown distribution centers 365 days a year. Only 20 or 30% of our apples get exported. And Countdown don't import any apples anymore because the preserving systems are very good. And on the machinery side, we have 32 tractors, but the youngest one is 30 years old. And our yard looks like a record yard. But in the old days, they were built to last. And I can't say the same of modern tractors and their structure. It's been a wise decision not to invest in depreciating assets. Johnny's handled that very well. And since we sold Fruit Packers, Joe's come back home. That was in 2016. And he's built a new 10,000 bin cool store with CA Smart Fresh facilities and large pack house, hugely automated with facilities for mechanical packing melons, green beans and apples. A lot of it's very new technology and experimentation. Also, Jonty has joined forces in beekeeping with Flanders and Moffat. Flanders came from Airtaki and it's working well, and they now have 2,000 hives up in high country, Manuka country, between Hope's Bay and Wairarapa. I go out the bottom doing a few local sales, look after stocks for the smoker room and the protection rooms. At high season, we had 100 employees this year, so that's about it.
That was something else. I'm going to get John Tainter to do a thank you. If there's any questions first, this might elongate the questions, I think, so I'd love you to talk now.
Well, Johnny, on behalf of the audience here, thank you for that journey of your life And it's one who spent a lot of time with you driving from Wellington to Auckland and many days around board tables and in discussions. I mean, I wasn't sure about Johnny when we got on the board together, but I learnt in 9 years this guy is a fantastic guy. And what a wonderful life story he's given us today. A story of courage and taking opportunities, of a person with vision. Johnny has a lot of very fine qualities. They didn't actually come out today, but he's got some wonderful qualities, like friendly with Paul Jones, buying a Ford off Paul Jones, and 60 years later he's still buying Fords.
In 32 years he sold me 19 new vehicles, and the following 24 years I've only bought one.
Anyway, he's been able to retire and you haven't. Johnny has made a tremendous contribution outside of what he told us today about his journey through, what a colourful journey it's been, as I said, but he's made tremendous contributions. Johnny, you've been a great citizen. You've been a great friend to people, a great citizen, and a tremendous contribution here. But to the New Zealand growers, in our time, in the 9 years you spent on the board, you were a great grower representative. You battled for growers long and hard, and you made a difference in people's lives. That's a great thing to have done. You absolutely did that. Now, Johnny has always accented the positive in life. He looks at opportunities and goes for them. You picked that up in his talk today. But he's got one word that I'll never forget. He used regularly when I was with him. He'd be talking about something, an opportunity or something new, and he'd say, "That's terrific." And for me, that sums up Johnny. He's positive, and he does things in an optimistic way, and he aims to make things terrific. So Johnny, thanks for that terrific speech.
Thank you, John. Are there any big questions you got? I'm going to hold Johnny here, and if anyone would like a wee word with him, you won't mind, Johnny, will you? But thank you so much. One round of applause for a wonderful speaker.